Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Bob Gwaither to Your Health. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Adam.
I'm really looking forward to our show today. We're going to be talking about the Program of Narrative Medicine at Columbia University, really a leader in the United States, about using narrative medicine to teach students of all types and probably established physicians as well about value in healthcare. I suspect you don't have to be convinced.
Not even a little bit.
Yeah, and you've been doing work teaching healer's arts, and which involves some aspects of all kinds of narrative and other elements to really teach the art of medicine to students.
That's right. And we also have a faculty meeting once a month to talk about the very same issues.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to talking with some of the leaders of this program, Dr. Craig Irvine and lecturer Danielle Spencer, about how illness can shape care and their new book, The Principles and Practice of Narrative Medicine. But first, we're going to talk about some important research. And the very first one has to do with autism and perhaps a link to grandmother, smoking, and pregnancy. Whoa, that's an interesting one.
This is a really interesting study because it's done in this study called The Children of the 90s. And it goes back to the generation of the baby, the mom, and the grandmom. And that's not many studies that'll do that to follow for a long time people to see what happened. And one of the impressive things that they found was that if the maternal grandmother smoked during her pregnancy with her own mother, the girl is 67% more likely to display certain traits linked to autism, and 53% of those young women are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder later.
Yeah, you know, this was over 14,500 participants from Bristol, a sister city across the ocean, and published actually in Scientific Reports. And it suggests that there's more complexity, but some of these risk factors like smoking, which we know causes all kinds of adverse health effects. And the question would be, well, how does it link to the grandparent? And there's some evidence that, you know, we know there's DNA damage from smoking, and this DNA can damage the eggs, which could influence the next generation. There's really no benefit to smoking during pregnancy and every reason to quit smoking. This is just one more possibility to help motivate people.
And it's interesting that we don't really know what causes this, but it's interesting to contemplate the so-called mitochondrial DNA. All of us have our mother's mitochondrial DNA, male or female, because it's not in the nucleus of the cell. It's in these little power packs.
Right. And it may suggest that you need to go back beyond what the mother and the father and the things they're exposed to, but things that the grandparents are even exposed to.
Yet another reason not to smoke.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And it has to do with sensitization to the metal that's in joint replacements. I found this really interesting and not something I really thought about. Like joint replacements, a lot of them really are involved cobalt, chromium, and nickel, some of the implant components. Ah, I know about nickel allergy. We see that in people with earrings all the time and rings.
So this is published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. Primary author is Dr. Nadim Halab. And, you know, basically what they did was they had a look at 2,613 patients who had unexplained pain in their joints after joint replacement surgery. Nothing red or hot or swollen or no physical abnormalities, but they just had this unremittent pain.
And the thought was that this may be due to some sensitization from the metal causing what we might see on the outside, but on the inside. And these patients underwent a lymphocyte transformation test, LTT, to look at how the cells might be sensitized to metals. And they found a much higher rate of sensitization among women than men. Now, I must say, I was struck less by the difference in the two, but the fact that how many people actually have a sensitization to these components in metals. It was high in both groups.
Right. And they even went back and said, well, before the surgery, what percentage of you had any problems with pain? And 29% of women prior to blood testing had it, and only 4% of men. So it seems to afflict women more than it does men. And for those of you who've had nickel allergy, as Adam suggests, from earrings or any other metal that's come in contact for a while with your skin. It can be an impressive physical thing, but you can't see it when inside the joint without opening up the joint again, and nobody's advocating that.
No, and we don't know whether or not this sensitization happened beforehand, and so once they had the implant, then they were kind of primed, or maybe they didn't have it, and then once they had the implant, they developed a sensitization. I do think this is something to actually ask your orthopedic doctor about. If I were having a joint replacement, I'd want to know a little bit more about this. And is there anything I can do to help prevent that? Is there anything less sensitizing in terms of the implants that can be used? These are things I would want to know.
I would want to know those too. I think that the orthopedic surgeons may need to change somehow because, you know, once that thing's in there, you don't want to have it go awry.
Yeah. Speaking about going awry, this next research is a little scary, but maybe we'll put it in some context. And this has to do with children that were conceived through fertility treatments. Are they at increased risk for developing pediatric cancer? Research, this was done at Ben-Gurion University in Israel.
They had a look at two different kinds of fertility treatments, in vitro fertilization, the so-called test tube baby, and also ovulation induction, where you take pills and it makes you ovulate. And they had a look at the babies after those deliveries. And it was a big study because there were like over 250,000 newborns in the study.
1.5 out of 1,000, the children who were conceived of in vitro fertilization had cancer. For those that were the ovulation, it was 1 per 1,000 developing a cancer. And those who were naturally conceived was 0.59 out of 1,000. So you could say it was, well, three times higher if in vitro fertilization, and that is worrisome, but these were relatively rare. I think this is not something to suggest, you know, in any ways not to conceive in vitro or ovulation, but I think it is something that perhaps we should be a little bit more alert to. And maybe it's part of the counseling. I think we need more data, but this is about as good as it gets in terms of the large amount and saying, okay, there's something to be at least aware of.
Yeah, it's a small number of people actually, but it's still a risk and they need to hear about it.
Yeah, let's talk about something we all need to hear about. It's last research that matters, Bob. And that's about Medicare patients who get discharged from the emergency room. And, you know, we think, oh, that's a pretty good thing because we're keeping people out of the hospital. But there's a certain percentage of those who actually die within a short period of time. And is that number higher if you got discharged than if you were admitted? So hospitals that are higher in keeping people out of the hospital, are they going to necessarily have maybe higher rates of some of those people dying? Interesting question.
And I think the public needs to understand that Medicare is bringing pressure on physicians to not admit people to hospitals when they don't need it. And so they count how many you do and don't admit.
Yeah, this was more than 10,000 Medicare patients who they didn't have life-threatening illnesses. So this was in the British Medical Journal. And they really looked at, you know, what was the risk. They this was care delivered to over 16 million Medicare patients between 2000 and 2012. And of those that were discharged, 0.12% died within 7 days, about 10,000 deaths a year. And the rate of those who were discharged compared to and died versus those who were admitted and died was really, you know, suggesting potentially that those who were being discharged in this group, you were keeping out some patients who maybe should have come in the hospital. I don't know. That's how I'm reading it. I don't know if this proves that, but it's something to be concerning.
And the deaths were primarily cardiac, like all people in that age group. But they did have a look at the people that died and before the 2 weeks, and they found that they got discharged home with higher rates of confusion, shortness of breath, and a diagnosis of pneumonia that somebody thought they could treat as an outpatient.
You know, bottom line here, Bob, I suspect good medicine is good medicine. If you need to come in the hospital, you should come in the hospital.
Yeah, you don't need to meet people, don't need to be admitted, but you kind of lean in favor of somebody who's still ill appearing.
And I just think always ask the question, is there something influencing whether or not someone gets admitted outside their medical condition? If the answer is no, then I'm in good stead. I like that. If it is, then let's not go there.
And one other thing is worthy of note, which is that a lot of these people died of narcotic overdose. And I think they probably got their prescription going out the door and had other things that were conflicting with it, or they could have had this situation. And that's a thing you got to avoid in everybody, too.
Yeah, good point. Well, that'll conclude the research portions of our show. When we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Craig Irvine and Danielle Spencer, co-authors of a new book, The Principles and Practices of Narrative Medicine, about how the story of illness shapes care. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with the Program of Narrative Medicine at Columbia University's Academic Director, Dr. Craig Irvine, and lecturer Danielle Spencer, co-authors of a new book, Principles and Practices of Narrative Medicine, about how the story of illness can shape care.
Welcome, Dr. Irvine and Ms. Spencer.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
How did you get interested in narrative medicine? Did you wake up one day, or were you just born this way? What about you, Dr. Irvine? And then we'll hear from you, Ms. Spencer.
So I did a doctorate in philosophy, and as part of my doctoral work, I did a great deal of study of narrative theory, which I incorporated into the work I was doing in the field of philosophy. And when I graduated, I moved to New York City and at some point heard about an opening after adjuncting for a while at the Center for Family Medicine here at Columbia University, and took a job there as a sort of writing grants and doing administrative work, and began collaborating with Rita Sharon, who was then developing the nascent field of narrative medicine. And we really just found that our interests aligned really beautifully. You know, I had been doing some teaching in narrative ethics, medical ethics, and with my interest in narrative, it just really fit. And I became one of the core founding faculty members of the program.
And what about you, Ms. Spencer?
Well, prior to entering the field, I was doing something completely different. But I will say that I think I've always been drawn to areas where there are different discourses in different fields that are in contact with each other. So I was working in the art world and the music industry. I was the art director for a musician named David Byrne. And then I just had I had a growing interest in nonfiction memoirs by clinicians. And I was very interested in the lack of communication between people inside of medical culture and those outside of it. And it seemed to me that this was an important juncture because we all have bodies and so forth, and I was drawn to that kind of difficulty. And then I heard about this program, and I didn't know quite what it was, but I was interested in it. So I came and I actually did the master's degree in our program, and now I'm on the faculty of the program as well. So that's my story.
And you're sticking to it. We love it.
Exactly, yeah.
Before we begin, I think it's important for us to define narrative medicine for our listeners. What is it?
Well, we define it as the discipline. It's an intellectual and clinical discipline. The aim of the discipline is to really fortify healthcare, to enhance the skills by which persons receive accounts from other persons, the ability to recognize, absorb, interpret, and be moved to actions by the stories of others. Of course, our principal interest, as the name implies, narrative medicine, is in healthcare. We're particularly interested in enhancing that ability to tell and receive from each other narratives, our stories of each other, between clinician and patient. And, you know, much of our work over the years has been on specifically addressing the need for clinicians to be able to attend to those stories to get a better, more full picture of their patients' lives and what really affects the health of their patients.
Ms. Spencer, can I ask you a question then? Because at the beginning of your book, there's some really prestigious authors you guys have collaborated together. But you have a quote there that I just want to read. It says, "We are so much embedded in our relations with others that those very relations are difficult to discern clearly. We are in the thick of relationality that's almost impossible to fully appreciate, a little like the eye trying to see itself." Is it that we don't appreciate the narratives that we're in these relationships between doctors and patients?
I do think that's often the case, and thank you for bringing up that wonderful quote. I think that when you are in a particular profession, a particular world, things become naturalized, which is to say that you cease to think about how it is that they're constructed. So we do work a lot with clinicians, and you two are clinicians, and once you go to medical school and start residency and proceed, you don't think as much about how it is that you've been taught to think and process information. And this isn't in any way a pejorative judgment of that way of thinking, because in fact, it's a set of very powerful tools that are required to practice medicine well. At the same time, it's also a way of framing experience, right? So, you know, you learn to do a SOAP note or, you know, any number of these other rubrics for how to take a patient history and put the information in a legible order so that it's intelligible to your colleagues. And again, it's nothing against that, but that is a form of narrative. And so a lot of our work is aimed at trying to expose that there is no neutral form of narrative and to ask the question, what does a particular form of narrative teach us? What does it highlight? What does it diminish? And what effect does that have on the encounter?
You know, it seems to me that in today's medicine, a real challenge is communication. And in part, that's because so many patients are an hour scheduled to see physicians and they can't seem to be graceful and do that. So you see people counting how many seconds it is before some doctor talks and interrupting the patient.
Wait, let me interrupt you. No, just kidding.
No, go ahead.
That's good.
Because is that a large part of the need for this, to have people focus on what the patient has to say?
Absolutely, and focus in a particular way. So, you know, I think that much of the training involved, and again, it's not at all to diminish the importance of the ways that clinicians have been trained, what they've been trained to listen for, and the ways that they've been trained to process that information, but to add that it's very important to understand that you're not just extracting information from a story. You know, I think a lot of doctors are very good at that, but to understand that the story itself contains very valuable information that might pertain to the patient's context, their health, their community, their background, and that information is conveyed in quite complicated ways often in the structure of the story, the way that the story is constructed by the patient. That it's not just, you know, what can we take away from the story, but how can we attend to the story itself and understand that it's the life of the patient that's expressed in that story.
And Ms. Spencer, let me ask you a question, because you also write about in your book about emotions and that emotions are not neutral, they're not politically neutral, and that the people who sometimes maybe these emotions don't get appreciated or expressed in the medical encounter are people who experience difficulties accessing or disparities in care, people of color, females, LGBTQ. Is this a part of the importance of what we need to hear, the emotion of a narrative, and express that? How does that work?
Well, I think so. Absolutely, it is. I think this goes back to this question of being aware of how narrative framing is happening. And so if you're able to become aware that a particular way of telling and listening is minimizing people's emotions, then you can ask the question in that particular context. You can say, well, okay, what are the potential effects of this? And I mean, I think we all know that in a clinical setting, emotions are incredibly important, at the very least on the basis of clinician-patient relationship and the degree of trust and openness that is essential for good care. But I also want to add that I think of this in very reciprocal ways, that this isn't simply about How can clinicians attend to patients better? I think that is a central focus of the field. But you have two people in this case, sometimes more, meeting. And I think it's essential to also think about the reciprocity of that in terms of, well, what's going on for the clinician as well? And what responsibilities does the patient have toward the clinician? We don't talk about that as much, but I think that's important too.
What do you mean by that? Maybe an example. Do you have an example?
There's a lot of lack of understanding by people outside the medical field of what goes on, you know. So if you go to the emergency department and you see the doctor for, in your view, you know, less than a minute, that doesn't mean that physician is spending the rest of the time on their Facebook account. I mean, there's just so much else that goes on that remains unseen, and that might be something that can help when a patient is understandably frustrated in a situation like that.
We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with the Program of Narrative Medicine at Columbia University's Academic Director, Dr. Craig Irvine, and lecturer Danielle Spencer, co-authors of a new book, Principles and Practices of Narrative Medicine, about how the story of illness can shape care. We'll be right back. This is Your Health, Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwerther.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwerther. We've been talking with the Program of Narrative Medicine at Columbia University's Academic Director, Dr. Craig Irvine, and lecturer Danielle Spencer, co-authors of the new book, The Principles and Practices of Narrative Medicine, about the story of how illnesses can shape healthcare. And right before the break, you all were doing a really nice job, I think, of helping us understand what's happening in the encounter that really is worthy of study, reflection. And I want to bring up one or two things that you really talk in the book, and maybe you can tell us how it works. You talk about writing about, thinking about floating bridges. What's that concept about, and why is that important for learners and patients?
This is a story in one of the early chapters that I co-wrote with our colleague Maura Spiegel by Alice Munro, and we use this as an extended example of close reading and the kind of prompted writing that we do in the classroom. And in this story, it's a story about a woman who has cancer, but the story doesn't seem to be primarily about that. And to make a longer story a bit shorter, at the end of the story, there's a scene in which she's standing on a floating bridge. And what we describe is that we use a writing prompt in this context where we ask our students to describe a time you were on a floating bridge, and we give them only 5 minutes to write to the prompt. It's both literal in the sense that there's a floating bridge in the story, and it's metaphoric in the way that many people choose to respond to it. And they write about ways in which they feel that they have been or currently are at a juncture between two chapters of their own lives. And the things that they write can be quite unexpected and beautiful.
Have either of you shared a floating bridge in your own lives with your students that you would care to share with listeners?
We always try to do the exercise alongside our students. Craig, can you think of any of your responses?
For that particular prompt, I think that one of the things that, so for instance, it depends on the group, but if I'm writing with a group of medical students, there's always with medical students, a feeling of unease, a feeling of being kind of in between, that they're not yet doctors, but they already have clinical responsibilities often when they start their clinical rotations. And certainly even when they're interns, they are doctors, but they still don't feel placed in that way yet. So a story like that can really help those learners engage with a feeling of being in between and finding your way. And so a story I might tell might also relate to a time in my life when I was, not yet sure of my direction, not yet sure that I had my feet, not confident yet about my path. I certainly have experienced a number of those in my life, so it's not difficult to find examples.
I was just thinking, I'm thinking about, recently my mother passed, and I think about in the exam room when I'm dealing with someone who may be in the later stages of their life or a parent of theirs, I may sometimes share something about that I wouldn't have shared before. I'm not writing about it yet, but it seems to me that the ability to share something that may be a floating bridge may help, but it's not easy.
Yeah, it must not be sure whether or not that's going to be the right thing in that context. You never know. Part of the work that we do, especially with clinicians in training, is provide a space where you're not in the exam room, so you can safely share these kinds of experiences in a way that you might not otherwise.
Dr. Irvine, you mentioned earlier that social justice is a passion of yours, and you somehow weave that into the experiences around the course. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. I mean, for instance, in our master's program, we have a course specifically addressing social justice and its relation to our field. And, you know, it's really understanding that relationship between any clinician, a clinician and any patient is not just about the two people in the room, but about the greater societal structures that have a great deal to do with how someone is heard, whether their story is heard, whose voice is considered worthy of being heard. And all of that requires reflection, deep reflection, not just on an individual basis, but on a societal basis about what it is that structures that relationship. The giving and receiving accounts of self, the telling of stories, is about more than just what's happening between these two people in that room.
You know, Ms. Spencer, you and Dr. Irvine wrote a chapter about philosophy and narrative. I was struck by at the end of that chapter, there's a section about the soul, which seems to me right at the juncture of things. How do you bring in a discussion of the soul in the context of teaching learners to really delve in their own belief in the philosophical interplay between mind and body?
Well, that's a great question. There are a number of ways to do it, and I think in these chapters we offer a way in to study philosophy alongside literature. So this is this beautiful poem by David Ferry called Soul, and it begins, "What am I doing inside this old man's body? I feel like I'm the insides of a lobster." And one way in with a group of people is to read this poem together and to discuss it, because it's very evocative, and to think, well, what does that mean? And to start asking specific questions, and this is where close reading comes in. Why do you think he writes, "I feel like I'm the insides of a lobster," rather than "I feel like I'm a lobster"? And how do you respond to that? And what do you think, you know, what do you think is going on here? And people begin to reflect on the relationship between the mind and the body and the soul. And these are, of course, questions that we've been trying to address for millennia, you know, in every culture around the world. Literature offers a way into those questions when you don't necessarily have the time or inclination to go back and close read the philosophical texts. They're the same ideas, but you're getting at them in different ways.
Nice.
And your students get the opportunity to reflect right along with you.
And yes, well, exactly. And it's really hard to generalize, but I would say broadly speaking, the approach is, we try not to be didactic. You know, even in a master's level classroom, there is, you know, teaching going on, but it's really, we always aim for a collaborative learning environment where those of us who are called instructors are learning a great deal from the group as well.
You know, I love it. You cite one of our heroes, my heroes, William Carlos Williams, who wrote in your book, you say, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." And I must say, you have a wonderful book that should prove useful to students, to anyone really interested in reflecting more deeply on this principles and practices of narrative medicine. And if each of you could leave our listeners with one final thought about narrative medicine, what would it be? You first, Dr. Irvine.
So, you know, I guess I would really encourage, you know, reading and writing. And if I could just tell one more quick story, you know, one of my residents that I worked with a number of years ago wrote a story in response to a prompt. The prompt was, "Write about a time you were moved by someone's suffering." And she wrote a story about an alcoholic patient who had died on the inpatient service. And this man's widow had shown her a picture of him when he was very young, and she was weeping, and she had been divorced from him, but she, you know, as the resident said, had found her love after his death. And it was writing about that experience, not just telling it, but writing about it, representing it to herself, that brought home to this resident what alcoholism meant, after having years, of course, of listening to lectures about alcoholism as a disease. Representing the experience to herself, then sharing it with others and hearing them reflect back to her what they're hearing in the story allowed her to learn something very important. And she still says now, 10 years later, that she never saw an alcoholic in the same way again. And it's that combination of reading, entering into literature, and allowing it to expand our worldview, and then representing our own experience and sharing it that I think we're most passionate about.
And Spencer, a final thought?
I'm going to echo what Craig has said. The power of close reading and close analysis, particularly with a group of people, and how that enriches our understanding. And my very quick example is in the class I'm currently teaching about bioethics and narrative, which we combine to call it narrative ethics. We're doing a group project looking at the current X-Men film, Logan, and we're finding so much rich resonance there about, you know, aging and mortality. And there won't be any spoilers here, but, you know, race and gender and all sorts of things. And you never get to the end of it. It just keeps getting richer and richer. So I think that people are very curious about, well, what is narrative medicine? And what I would say is that curiosity doesn't end, because narrative medicine is really about asking questions, and it's about a site of inquiry. And so anybody who's interested, we welcome you to join us.
Well, I would say the end of that movie and the end of your book and the end of this conversation is stay tuned. there's more to come. Well, we really need to thank you, Dr. Craig Irvine and Ms. Danielle Spencer, co-authors of the new book, The Principles and Practice of Narrative Medicine, about sharing your passion, your stories with your health listeners today. We really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll actually be answering your questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. Bob, for the House Call segment of the show today, we're going to hear about listeners' health questions and concerns, and any listener can send us their own concern or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we've got some really good House Calls today. I'm really looking forward to them. And we'll ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first one about kind of an unfortunate experience that we don't like.
I recently took my teenager to see a specialist who did a biopsy on a small nodule that we had recently noticed. She hates needles and was understandably anxious. After he was finished, I happened to oversee him making faces to a nurse, mocking my daughter's anxiety. I understand that medical professionals need to find humor in the pressures of their jobs, but this really eroded my trust. Do you think I need to find her a new doctor?
Well, I got to say that I'm not as kind to this guy as he is.
Yeah, my first instinct was I just like poke him right in the...
Because that is really, really unprofessional. And if she or her daughter finds that that's going to be in the way of their relationship, they should get somebody else to deal with. I mean, that's a pure and simple question. And the other side of the coin is physicians need to do their joking somewhere else, not in the room in front of the patient. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, I think – how would that physician feel if – the patient started mocking the mannerisms that a lot of physicians do when they're doing procedures. A lot of times we're doing procedures like, you know, like it's like when I'm looking on my iPhone, I sometimes pull my glasses up, I look down, I squint, you know. I'm sure I do things all the time as a provider that could be mocked. So, you know, I think you're going to have to talk with this doctor. Laura, if this would happen to you or a loved one, would you talk to your doctor? What would you do?
I would probably talk to somebody else in my life who has medical experience to make sure that I'm not crazy for being a little offended. But on behalf of a family member, yeah, I'd be upset.
Yeah, I think it's very natural. I think your instinct is spot on here. I think you do need to talk. You're either going to get a new provider, which may end up anyhow, or at least let this provider know, because that's feedback, because you got to get feedback to your provider. Otherwise, that provider can't get better, and it's going to happen again and be more dangerous.
Well, that takes a little courage, and it doesn't add to what I think she wants to do and should. But if she wants to confront him, then more power to her.
Yeah. And by the way, we hope the biopsy turned out okay.
Yeah.
Most importantly, let's listen to our very next House Call, Laura.
I've been on Lexapro for several years to treat moderate depression and anxiety. I've felt much better recently, and I'm wondering if I might be able to go off the antidepressants. What do you think?
Really good question, and one We kind of get a lot. Actually, a lot of people just stop their medication because they're feeling better. And that happens not just for depression. It happens for high blood pressure. I've seen it for diabetes. I've seen it. Actually, someone had a cardiac stent placed and they were on a blood thinner. And a week or two later, I was feeling great. They stopped it. Oi, don't do that. So this, though, was a complicated one because some people can do well off their antidepressants. Right, Bob?
They sure can. And I would say this, that there's no rush to get off of it, that if it's really doing a good job, I personally, my style would be to taper this slowly and see if symptoms reemerge. You don't need to crash in order to decide that you do need the medicine. So I think if she wants to try coming off slowly, then that's a legitimate thing. She may get symptoms back and then go back up to the stable dose.
Right, and do it with talking with your provider because a third of patients probably can get off the medicine for a good while, maybe forever. A third of the patients will not be able to get off the medicine. They really have quick relapse. And so, you know, it's hard to know which third you fall into. Another third may get off of, but then slowly get worse. The problem is that sometimes these things are genetic. Some things are biologic. Sometimes there's a combination. You may have had good skills you've developed. You may have been in a therapeutic relationship. You may have had situational things that have changed. We're so glad you're better. We want you to stay that way. Talk with your doctor. Come up with a plan. Certainly reasonable to ask about it. What's our very last house call, Laura?
I'm a 48-year-old man, and I've been noticing that I have more dandruff than usual. Do you have any advice for getting rid of flakes?
Well, besides clicking your heels three times and say, there, go away, go away, go away. And none of it, no man, woman, anyone really likes dandruff. We call it cradle cap in children. We call it seborrhea in adults frequently. And it's a flakiness of the scalp. It's in the family of conditions that we would sometimes call eczema of the scalp, dandruff of the scalp. It's a chronic recurring problem that can be controlled, but it usually is not cured.
So I agree with that. And I might go see my doc and be sure that I've not got something that neither one of us expects, but it likely is one of these common skin problems. And a lot of people are pretty well controlled by using shampoo that has selenium sulfide in it, like Selsun or Head & Shoulders. Start off using it maybe once, twice a week, and not build up to doing it every day because it's going to make your hair be pretty oily if you do. But that can help. And then dermatologists will even hand out steroid lotions to apply to your scalp. And some people get a lot of benefit from that.
Yeah, it's important. Like Bob's hinting, we want to make sure it's not psoriasis, kind of the next phase, more difficult. Definitely would require some prescription medications. We'll say that stress sometimes certainly worsens seborrhea of the scalp. So I wouldn't ignore if you're under increased stress. And certainly, both a dermatologist and a primary care physician, there are prescription products. There are also a topical shampoo called Nizoral, which is a type of antifungal, which sometimes has a beneficial impact. With these topical shampoos, keep it on for 5 minutes. Most people put their shampoo on, get it right off, or with this, maybe a minute or two. You got to keep it on for 5 minutes to have a chance for it really to have some impact. That's really important. You know, the great questions today, and we want to thank really all of our listeners today, Bob, for listening to Your Health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to our listeners. They can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. They can send their own questions to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dr. Craig Irvine and Danielle Spencer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.